You've been listening to Real Talk with Rodney Hyde on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, thank you for joining us from the UK. You've just had a very big win in the courts of law regarding statin. Let's talk, first of all, about the background to the case, and I understand there's quite a history going back to 2019 and a rather disgraceful article written about you and your attitudes to statins. Can you background the case for us, Malcolm?
Yeah, well, it's going back, gosh, it seems a dim and distant, before COVID, when there was such a time. And March the 3rd, 2019, the Mail on Sunday, which is sort of one of the biggest red newspapers in the UK and around the world, published sort of two articles about myself, Dr. Zoe Harcombe and Dr. Asim Malhotra, who didn't take on the case because his mother had just died, so he didn't want to have any part in it. And essentially, we were accused that because of articles we'd written, papers we'd written, things we'd said, literature we'd given, saying that statins have only marginal benefits, really, and they have more adverse effects than sort of widely acknowledged. But by saying such things, we had caused thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people to stop taking statins because of this. Thousands had had heart attacks, strokes, and died. And what we did was worse than Andrew Wakefield with MMMR and had caused more damage. And on top of that, they basically said that we didn't believe anything that we were saying. We just did this to gain followers and make money. So basically, essentially, we were venal, corrupt, lying propagandists. And these are the words that were used, purely interested in making money and gaining status and causing the deaths of thousands of people. That is the crux of what these articles said. And they said it in almost those terms in places. So we thought, well, you can't say that because it's complete rubbish. And so we took them to court. And it's taken an awful, awful long time. But hurrah, we have won. And that's, is that enough background?
I think so. I'm just intrigued, though, by the trial process, because there have been lots of claims made by doctors and medical researchers on both sides of the fence, particularly during the COVID vaccine era, about how good and how bad the COVID vaccines might be. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later down the track. But on the matter of statins, when it came to the actual court hearings, did you have to produce scientific evidence in the court that the judge could balance and the judge could find out whether or not you were right or wrong?
Well, yes and no. It gets complicated because in a libel case, the first defense for a libel case is, was this personal opinion, the person who wrote the articles, was their personal opinion on a matter of public interest, which is a primary defense. So what we had to, what our lawyers had to say was, well, this was rubbish. You didn't believe any of this stuff. And because of what you wrote was actually so misleading, and the judge used the word misleading, that your case cannot hold up. So you're accusing us of manipulating data, whereas you manipulated data. Now, there was quite a lot of data discussed around, if you like, in the periphery. As the judge himself said, he's not going to sit there and make a decision as to whether or not statins are highly beneficial or not highly beneficial. They can't do that. That's really not what the case was about. So the first part of the case was essentially, you know, was what he was saying his opinion? Was it in the public interest to say so? And the judge basically said no. And it's really fascinating because in the background he had Barney Kalman, who is the health editor who wrote the articles or caused them to be written, as we say in legal parlance. His understanding of science was so poor that it was almost like, you know, I did describe it as taking, he took a knife to a gunfight and he had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. I mean, at one point, a very simple statistical analysis was discussed whereby the group in Oxford who do a lot of these analyses had said, in the elderly, if those people over 70 only a quarter take statins, but if they all took statins, according to their meta-analysis, this would save 8,000 lives a year. Now, at that point, and this may have triggered these articles, both myself and Zoe Harcombe, my co-claimant, said, well, actually, if you look at the statistics, they don't even support that claim. There is no statistical support for this. The confidence intervals crossed one, which basically means it could have just been a finding by chance. And you can't state a fact like that. So we both wrote blogs saying this is absolute bollocks. They can't say this. It's not even true. And this was discussed in court. And we looked at confidence intervals and we looked at the figures and we looked at the statistics. At the end of which our lawyer said to Barney Kalman, and did you understand the scientific paper or the statistics? To which his answer was no.
So I get the feeling this reporter, this health editor, is like many in his position in various media organizations around the world. And I've seen them in the organizations that I've worked at. They are, well, one hates to use the phrase, but I think it's pretty close to the truth. They are mouthpieces for pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical researchers. I saw it particularly when I worked briefly in Australia with the way the drug companies were pushing drugs to the television reporter at Channel 9 with almost a cure for cancer coming online pretty much every week, it would seem. So it would appear that this man here has fallen into the same trap, essentially a good PR operative for drug researchers. Is that fair comment?
Well, I think it's fair comment. I mean, if there's a bit more background on this case, is that around the world over the years, many other researchers, quite very high-quality researchers, in fact, Dr. Michael Michel, we should call him because he's French, de Logero, who's a professor, who actually set up and ran a very famous study in nutrition called the Leon Hart Study, which was the first one to prove, in inverted commas, that the Mediterranean diet was healthy. So he's hardly a nut job fringe guy. But he was attacked a couple of years before we were because he doesn't like statins and he thinks the cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease. And various articles were written in newspapers and journals stating that because of what he had said, thousands of people stopped taking their statins, hundreds of thousands, and thousands of people have died as a result. Exactly the same attack was used. And in Australia, a reporter that I know well, Marianne De Masi, who you may have heard of, was running programs called Catalyst on Australian Broadcasting Corporation. This is going back to 2013, I think, was it? She did two programs, one saying that saturated fat doesn't cause heart disease, and the other one saying that statins have been overhyped. They don't cause as many benefits as are claimed, and the statistics are all manipulated. And in fact, I advised her on those programs, and I wrote her an email after they came out saying, Marianne, I do hope you realize you are going to be subjected to outrageous and horrible attacks, all right? And I have that email somewhere. I kept it. And after these programs came out, she was ruthlessly attacked. She lost her job at ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She had a PhD in something or other that I can't remember what it was, but they attacked her PhD, said she'd falsified the data and tried to strip her of her PhD so she could no longer call herself doctor. She was ruthlessly, ruthlessly attacked. And you go to the United States of America. Well, I go back to my hero, Uffe Ravenskoff. He's a Swedish researcher who set up a group called the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics, which shortens to THINKS, which is quite good. And he wrote a book called The Cholesterol Myth, and this is going back 25, 30 years. And at one point in a TV debate where he wasn't actually present, his book was burnt, literally burnt, live in a television studio. And I can give you examples of around the world of anyone who dares to attack, A, the hypothesis that saturated fat raises cholesterol and causes heart disease, or whether it just causes it in some other unidentified sort of weird fashion. They get attacked ruthlessly. And that goes back to this guy called John Yudkin in the 70s, who wrote a book called Pure, White, and Deadly, where he said that saturated fat was fine, but it was actually sugar that was a real problem. And he was attacked by Ansel Keys, who was the originator of the diet heart hypothesis, and basically put his head down, gave up research at that point. He was so ruthlessly attacked. And also by Harvard researchers, who it was then found out that they'd received very large sums of money to write articles on behalf of the sugar industry. I think there's something called the United States Sugar Association, damning saturated fat and exonerating sugar. So behind the scenes, not just the pharmaceutical industry, there are other nefarious players.
Vested interests, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So, Malcolm, let's get back to your case. You say you have won the case against the Mail on Sunday. I think the corporate company is Associated Newspapers. More significantly, they've decided not to appeal. They've waved the white flag. What happens now in terms of, A, your hypothesis, and B, your reputation? Does your stand on statins, that is, they are harmful and not very effective for heart disease, does that get more widespread coverage now? And B, are you going to have your reputation restored?
My reputation has been mud for 40 years. I think someone scraped a little square centimeter of mud off, but it will rapidly be reapplied, I would imagine. I sometimes sort of call my stand and my position of being like a hedgehog, a needle against a hedgehog. I don't know if you've ever heard this. There's one little prick against thousands.
Yes, I get the analogy.
The forces, we're talking a multi-trillion dollar industry. And they have the major researchers, and these people who are professor this and professor that and professor the other and professor inside out and upside down, who are all absolutely just singing this off this same hymn sheet. I mean, the statins kind of are gone because they ran out of patent 15 years ago. So it's difficult to make vast sums of money. But the cholesterol hypothesis, the hypothesis that cholesterol causes heart disease, we're seeing vastly more expensive drugs now to lower your, it's not actually cholesterol, it's low density lipoprotein. A statin is now $30 a year, virtually. I mean, it's cheap as chips, as we say in the UK. But these new ones we're talking, $8,000-$10,000 a year. And that's really expensive stuff. So there are still an awful lot of money in the cholesterol-lowering world. And associated with that, it's also within the low-fat diet stuff. So all these people producing low-fat rubbish that is supposed to be healthy. That's a trillion-dollar industry. So on one side, you have what I would like to call the truth, although other people may disagree with me. And on the other side, you have, I'm not quite sure what you'd call it without being too insulting.
Yeah.
In
a country like New Zealand, which relies so much on dairy products for export, you're saying that, frankly, we can just keep on layering the butter on our toast in the morning and it's not going to have any impact on our cholesterol levels and on our potential for heart disease. Is that a fair comment?
Well, be careful about the toast. I remember a lot of people have asked me, how did you get interested in this area? And this goes back, why this? why give yourself so much grief when you could have just followed the party line? And I said, well, I lived in Scotland. Well, I brought up in Scotland. And at the time I was at medical school, Scotland had the highest rate of heart disease in the world. It may not have, but anyway, it was very high towards the very top. And the perceived or the wisdom that we were all told was, it's because of the terrible Scottish diet. We eat this terrible Scottish diet, full of fatty stuff that raises our cholesterol level, and then we have heart disease. Now, I happen to go to France quite a lot. I like France very much. And when I go there, when I went there, I used to think, these people seem to eat an awful lot of saturated fat and dairy products and meat. And they have a heart disease rate, which is one of the lowest in the world. So I started looking at the French and realized that, yes, they do eat more saturated fat or animal fat or dairy. Don't worry, the complexities of this have become mind-boggling. As people desperately try to defend the central hypothesis, they create more and more. Oh, it's odd chain fatty. Anyway, when a fighter is about to be shot out of the sky, it releases chaff so that the opposition missiles miss it. You know, when a hypothesis comes under huge pressure, they just release 500,000 bits of rubbish into the air, and you've lost sight of the main target. But essentially, I then looked at the data, which is that I did a graph at one time, and they stopped producing the statistics, surprise, surprise, because they contradict the hypothesis. The five countries in Europe that have the highest consumption of saturated fat, which you would call basically animal fat or dairy or cheese or butter or whatever, compared with the five countries in Europe with the lowest consumption of saturated fat. And the average heart disease rate in the ones with the highest consumption was one-fifth that of those with the lowest saturated fat consumption. And now France had and has the highest saturated fat consumption in Europe and the lowest rate of heart disease. Switzerland has the second highest consumption of saturated fat in Europe and the second lowest rate of heart disease. And so it goes. So now you can't say that. I'm not suggesting that not eating saturated fat causes heart disease, although the statistics would very strongly suggest that. So once I started looking at it, I said, well, what else do the French do? The other things we're told that cause heart disease was smoking. Well, at that time, they smoked more and still do. And then there was the blood pressure levels, and the blood pressure in France and Britain was exactly the same. And then I looked at, what was the other things I looked at? Obesity. At that time, actually, surprisingly, the rates of obesity were the same. The amount of exercise taken. In fact, when you took the top 10 risk factors for heart disease between France and the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom should have had slightly less heart disease than France, according to established theory. And yet it was a sixth at that time, actually.
One so what is it, genetics?
No, it's not genetics. Japanese, however, the Japanese had the lowest rate of heart disease recorded in the world. But if you took a Japanese and sent them to America, they ended up with exactly the same rate of heart disease as the surrounding population. So, and you can't find a genetic. There is no genetics. In fact, there's a very interesting study in the UK called the Biobank study, where they take all the data they can find from the GP records and genetic testing and blah, blah, blah. And very unremarked research showed that they could find no genetic markers whatsoever for heart disease. Nothing. I mean, there is a thing that says if you have a first-degree relative who dies of heart disease, you're more likely to die of heart disease. That is true. However, that fails to take into consideration the fact that people who are related to each other tend to live lifestyles that are remarkably similar to each other. And therefore, there's pick one from any 500 other things. But genetically, no, there is no. And that included the cholesterol level, by the way, because what this study also found was they found that diabetes was a major cause of heart disease and smoking and highly raised blood pressure and all the sort of things you would expect to find. When it came to the cholesterol level, and they looked at a 1 millimole per liter increase in cholesterol, which is pretty significant. What they found was there was absolutely no association between any level of cholesterol and cardiovascular disease. None. Zero. Absolutely zero. And now these same people that do this research keep saying, oh, cholesterol causes heart disease. I'm going, but your study absolutely did not find any association whatsoever. Nothing. And that's like 600,000 people over 10 years or whatever it was. So the actual study, I mean, the actual hypothesis breaks down on contact with facts. Absolutely. Okay.
I'm waiting with bated breath. What causes heart disease then? Why do some countries have higher rates of heart disease than others?
Well, that would be telling. It's a good way of getting rid of people early. Reduces the pensions. And who wants to know anyway? We've got our answers and everyone's quite happy with them. Well, I have written a book recently called The Clot Thickens, which is the sort of end result of 40 years of research into heart disease. And essentially, what does cause heart disease? There is no one thing, obviously, because if there was one thing, we'd have found it by now. But essentially, what it does, I looked at a hugely intelligent, the best man I think I've ever met, who I was struggling with heart disease and saying, look, I know what doesn't cause it, but I cannot for the life of me work out what does cause it, because every time I look at it, it just flippers and changes in away from me. And Paul Rush, who has set up the American Institute of Stress, is now sadly dead, but he said, don't look at causes, look at process. What's the process that's going on with heart disease? You've got to start there, because then everything will fit around that process. And I'm not the first person to come up with a process. The process is that heart disease essentially is blood clotting, right? It's blood clots forming on blood vessel walls, and then they convert into what they call atherosclerotic plaques. And over time, repeated blood clots on the same point cause, you know, the narrowing and the heart disease and the heart attacks and whatever. And this hypothesis, believe it or not, was first proposed in 1852 by a researcher called Karl von Rokitansky in Vienna. And he looked at plaques in arteries and he said, what I see is blood clots in various stages of repair and transformation. That is what I am looking at. Because he was a pathologist. He worked with a guy called Rudolf Virchow. And he called it the incrustation hypothesis. And it was ignored and forgotten about. And then about 7 or 8 really high quality researchers over the years have said, what we are looking at here is a process of blood clotting. So work the process backwards. We know that the final event in a heart attack and a stroke, there are other forms of cardiovascular disease, is essentially a blood clot forms in an artery, blocks that artery fully, and then you have a stroke or a heart attack. That, in essence, is the final cause, if you like. So there's no argument that blood clotting is very key for heart attacks and strokes and other things, kidney damage. And then you move one step back and say, also, what we can see is that if you look at plaques that are in arteries, and you study them, and you give somebody a scan every year to see how their plaques are progressing, they don't gradually slowly grow as the cholesterol builds up in them. That's not how it happens. What happens is they jump. They call it phasic. In other words, what happens in an awful lot of cases is you've got an area of damage in your artery, or there's a bit of thickening there, and that becomes a focus for blood clots for various reasons, because it just is. Another blood clot forms on that area. It's not big enough to block the artery completely. So what happens, it becomes repaired at that point and then becomes incorporated as part of the existing plaque. And you can see this process when you look at plaques, because they're like tree rings. In many cases, what you see is an area where there's been a blood clot, another blood clot, another blood clot, another blood clot, another blood clot, one on top of the other for many, many years probably. And then the final one goes bang and kills you. So this is a process of blood clots building up on artery walls. And that happens because the artery wall can become damaged through various reasons, like smoking will damage your artery wall, and high blood pressure will damage your artery wall, and high blood sugar level will damage your artery wall, and the COVID-19 virus will damage your artery wall, along with lots of other viruses. And all these things that can damage the artery wall cause blood clots to happen. They're probably happening inside your artery right now and mine, but they're small and they're rapidly stop, and then they get covered over, and then mostly they disappear. But sometimes they don't disappear and they become a focus. And you can see this process happening. And then you have to ask the question, so I'll restart in a way, because people say, well, how can that happen? How can a blood clot then be within the artery wall where it's found? I said, well, it wasn't until about 25 years ago that people realized that the lining of your arteries is called endothelium. It's like wall tiles or or your skin or whatever. And if you strip some of that away, then it triggers a response to cause a blood clot, as it must do, because the body doesn't want blood leaking out of arteries. So it immediately causes a blood clot. That blood clot can't keep forming, or every time you started a blood clot, it would just get bigger and bigger and blocked every single time, which is what happens in sepsis. So what happens is the blood clot forms over the area of damage. It then becomes kind of not like a scab, but similar to that. And then there are cells in the blood that float around in your blood called endothelial progenitor cells. They recognize, here's a bit of damage. They cover it over, and they turn into endothelial cells, and the blood clot is now inside the artery wall. That is how it happens. This is, by the way, is not sort of mad, wacko stuff. This is widely accepted as to what happens. So when you look at mainstream medicine, they accept two things. They accept that blood clots cause, you know, a big blood clot causes a heart attack or a stroke or blocks an artery in your kidney. They accept that plaques, which are the actual plaque in your artery, is the thing that is, if you like, heart disease. It's not heart disease, it's cardiovascular disease, arterial cardiovascular disease. And they accept that the plaques grow through repeated episodes of clotting. But what they will not accept is that that is the thing that starts it in the first place, because cholesterol does that. Cholesterol leaks through your arteries, it thickens them, and then this clotting process is stopped.
All right. So it seems to me that if we want to reduce the incidence of heart disease, we have to stop blood clotting. And yes, excuse my ignorance, and I'm somebody who, as far as I know, does not suffer from heart disease, and I've never taken statins. I thought statins were blood thinners, which stopped blood clotting.
No. Statins were designed to lower, it's called low-density lipoprotein. We call it cholesterol, but cholesterol doesn't float free in your bloodstream because it's not water-soluble, so it would just form clumps and precipitate out and destroy your kidneys, I presume. So it's carried around in a little sphere called a lipoprotein, which is a lipid protein sphere, along with fats and other things, and that allows it to be transported in the blood. And the one that there are many types of lipoprotein, but the one that is thought to cause heart disease is low density lipoprotein, which you may or may not have heard of. And when we say cholesterol, what we sort of mean is low density lipoprotein. So the word itself,
LDL, is that what we're talking
LDL,
about?
LDL, yes.
Yeah.
And LDL is bad cholesterol, apparently, even though it's not cholesterol and it's not bad. And we have good cholesterol, which is another little lipoprotein that is supposed to take cholesterol away from your arteries and back to your liver, which, as an idea, is so ridiculous that it really comes under, if you believe that, you will believe anything.
Okay, and, so how do we stop blood clotting then?
Well, how do we stop blood clotting? Well, you stop damaging your arteries. So here's the thing is that I'll give you a quick pop quiz question. What disease do you think carries the greatest risk of cardiovascular, you know, this disease leads to the greatest risk of secondary cardiovascular disease. And the risk increase in one study that I looked at was 50,000%. Now, that is a proper risk factor, all right? None of your 0.01.
Yeah. Now, what disease would lead to cardiovascular disease?
The greatest risk. And if you don't know the answer, you won't be alone. You will be amongst 99.9999999% of doctors.
The risk no idea. I would say
you have no idea.
The flu.
Have a wild. Sorry.
The flu.
You're miles off. It does cause it, but it's very small. The answer is sickle cell disease. You know sickle cell disease?
No.
You don't know what it is. It's a disease. It's a genetic disease whereby your red blood cells look like sickles. You know, like the flag of Pakistan or the flag of Turkey. That sickle, right?
Sure.
Shape. So your red blood cells are sickled in shape. Now, it used to be that, and you can get it in different severities, but the children who had it severely would normally live till they were about four. Right? It's really not a nice thing to get. However, they now get blood transfusions, so they get sickled cells taken out and round, smooth blood cells put in. But I started looking at case histories of there was an eight-year-old boy who had gangrene of his feet, and he had gangrene of his feet because he had terrible damaged, narrowed arteries. They're called atherosclerosis, atherosclerotic arteries, all of his arteries were atherosclerotic. In other words, he had advanced heart disease that you would see in about a 100-year-old aged 8. And his underlying disease was sickle cell disease. And the reason why the sickle cell disease causes cardiovascular disease is because the sickle cells are hammering through your blood vessels and ripping off your endothelium and causing blood clots throughout the system. And in lesser severe examples, quite often the spleen becomes hugely enlarged with sickle cell disease, and that's because the red cells are removed from the system in the spleen. But in the people with sickle cell disease, they sometimes have to take out the spleen because it's huge and it can bleed. And when they look at it, they find all the arteries in the spleen are severely atherosclerotic. And the reason for that is very obvious. You have a hard, sharp red blood cell damaging the artery walls as it moves through it. And the other diseases that cause these problems are when you have diabetes, for example, you have a raised blood sugar. And one of the things that a raised blood sugar level does is your endothelial cells are also protected by a smooth layer of what they call glycoproteins, which is like hairs. You know, if you try and pick up a fish, mm-hmm. especially a freshwater fish, slips through your hand.
Yep.
Very slippery. Well, you can actually scrape the slipperiness off. That slipperiness, that Teflon, is actually called glycoprotein, and it allows the fish to swim more swiftly through the water, and it also stops bacteria and other nasty things getting into the fish itself. Now, if you turn the fish inside out, that's what you're doing with arteries. Arteries have this slippery layer inside them, and that's the primary protection mechanism for your blood vessels. And if you start damaging that layer, the blood vessels are more rapidly damaged. Things that damage that glycocalyx, as it's called, are high blood sugar levels, smoking, diabetes, obviously, certain viral infections like COVID and flu. In fact, any viral infection virtually will do this to you during that period when it's like this. So you have to protect your glycocalyx. Well, don't smoke, don't have high blood pressure. Another thing that will damage it is, you may have heard of the association between periodontitis and cardiovascular disease. In other mm-hmm. words, gum disease. People say, well, how the hell does gum disease cause heart disease? Well, the answer is that if you've got infection in your gums, that's bacterial, usually. Those bacteria shed toxins, are called exotoxins. The things that come out of bacteria that are nasty substances are called exotoxins. They're not deliberately designed to damage us, but they're the waste products of the bacteria. The waste products of the bacteria travel around in your bloodstream, attacking the lining of your blood vessels and causing it to break down and causing blood clots to form. And then the whole process happens, if you like. And COVID was interesting, because when COVID-19 came along, we had a condition where we had what we called, it's called multisystem inflammatory disease affecting the blood vessels. And people were saying, well, how on earth can this be caused by a viral infection? Well, the fascinating thing about COVID-19 is, for whatever reason, it enters the cell using a receptor that is found on blood vessel cells, the endothelial cells. They also exist in the lungs in a high level. Without that receptor, the virus can't get into the cell, because it's like a lock and key, if you like. It locks onto the A2 receptor. Is then drawn into the cell. And the cells that have A2 receptors become infected. And those cells are the cells that line your arteries and your veins, actually. And that's why in COVID, a lot of people got blood clots. A lot of people got blood clots. And in strange places that you hadn't seen them before. And there was an inflammation going on in all their blood vessels. And the mainstream was going, well, how on earth is this happening? And I just happened to be writing this book, The Clot Thickens, at the time, and I was looking at conditions that are called vasculitis disease, which are diseases that cause inflammation in your blood vessels. They might cause inflammation elsewhere. So rheumatoid arthritis causes inflammation in your joints, but it also can damage your blood vessels. And systemic lupus erythematosus and scleroderma, there's millions of them. We've all got really weird names like Wegener's granulomatosis and things that no one's ever heard of. But I was thinking, well, how are they causing the heart disease? Well, what they're doing is they're all doing the same thing. They're causing your immune system to recognize the lining of your arteries and veins as alien material, and they start attacking the lining of your blood vessels, which is really quite a scary thought. And it's also, there's a condition called antiphospholipid syndrome. Don't worry, you've never heard of it. It's also called Hughes syndrome. It affects quite a lot more people than you'd imagine. And antiphospholipid syndrome is dangerous because your cell membranes are made of phospholipids. That's what they're made up of. So you can imagine if your body starts to think, I don't like phospholipids and I'm going to destroy them, that this is not going to be a good thing. And people with this condition, that although it affects about 1 in 200 people, 50% of strokes under the age of 50 are caused by antiphospholipid syndrome.
Malcolm, you've talked much at a level which is, to be perfectly honest, above the level of a lot of lay people.
Yes.
But it is a subject that must be, may I say it, close to the hearts of everybody, because heart disease, as you say, is such a killer in Western societies. You've talked about causes. You obviously have some issues with the pharmaceutical industry, and I can understand why. But is there any pharmaceutical treatment for the sickle cell disease or for any of the causes of heart disease? Or does it in the end come down to basically looking after yourself?
Well, I think I did look at in the book was, okay, so what are the key things that you can do if you want to avoid heart disease? I mean, I'm saying there's hundreds of thousands of things out there, but of course they don't affect most people. What affects most people? What affects most people that causes heart disease would be probably diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And, you know, then you've got to say, well, how are you going to
treat
that?
And that's a food thing, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of a food thing. It's a combination of carbohydrate. Well, ironically, of course, if you tell people to stop eating fats, then what do people start eating more of, which is carbohydrates, which basically a carbohydrate includes sugar and, you know, everything, donuts and anything that's not a fat, basically, or protein. And people have been eating more fat, eating more carbohydrate, because we're told fat was bad for them. So they've shifted to eating a substance that is more likely to mean you gain weight, and is more likely to mean you're going to develop diabetes. So we've actually managed, ironically, by, you know, the advice we've given has been exactly wrong. Stop eating carbohydrate and start eating more fats, and stop eating low-fat yogurts and rubbish like that, and stop eating low-fat spreads that used to be called margarine, but margarine no longer exists, because margarine was found to kill people from heart disease. It was supposed to protect them, but it didn't. Almost everything we've done in this area has gone the wrong way around. Yes, we've told people to stop smoking, absolutely beneficial. But you know, in New Zealand and Australia, one of the biggest problems you've got is that going outside and sun exposure is gigantically beneficial to heart disease and all sorts of other cancers.
But we're told that we can't go outside, Malcolm, though we are talking by video link, this is going to be an audio playback later on, but you can see I've got some spots on my face because I had either some precancerous conditions on my face, one presumes from years of exposure to the harsh New Zealand sunlight. I've had some nitrous oxide, the dry ice, applied. So we're told that we must go out, slip, slop, slap, and cover up and all that sort of thing. That's the message that is being imposed upon New Zealanders now pretty much from the time that they're able to go outside the first time after birth.
Yes. I mean, there is an argument. Well, the problem with this is the confusion. It becomes complex and people like simple answers, all right?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something about cancer. Is skin cancer, malignant melanoma, is still one of the rarest forms of cancer that you can get, all right? Research from International Journal of Epidemiology I was looking at showed that if you expose the people, this is from America, people who are most exposed to the sun, top quintile, were 50% less likely to get breast cancer, 50% less likely to get prostate cancer, and 75% less likely to get colorectal cancer. Now, this is an observational study, all right? They're also significantly less likely to get heart disease. Now, skin cancer in the UK kills 2,000 people a year, like malignant melanoma. The other prostate cancer kills 22,000, right? So if you're going to say, well, you know, everything you do carries a risk. You go climbing mountains, you can fall off them and die, yes. But climbing mountains brings its own other advantages. I think pale-skinned people living in Australia have to be a little careful. But most of the cancers we're talking about are whilst they are cancers, basal cells, squamous cell, actinic keratosis, blah, 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 are basically treatable. And malignant melanoma, and people, no one believes this, I'm going to tell you, but you won't believe it either, but I'm going to tell you this is a fact. The people who are more exposed to the sun are less likely to get malignant melanoma.
You what? That is, yes. You what? That's crazy because people in New Zealand of my generation were sunbathing till the end of the day with just coconut oil back in the 1960s yes. and 70s. Farmers working outside without a hat. And then blow me down, they're lining up at the skin cancer clinics these days.
Yes.
Because they they've got BCCs, SCCs, and the melanomas.
I agree with BCCs, but not melanomas. The two groups in the United Kingdom who have the least, the lowest rate of malignant melanoma are farmers and outdoor construction workers. And
that is a statistical fact?
It's a statistical fact. Yeah, this is the same issue I have with my cholesterol stuff, and everyone goes, well, you're talking rubbish. I say people with higher cholesterol levels live longer than people with low cholesterol levels. That's a fact, all right? That's also a fact, okay? High cholesterol levels are associated, we're not talking vast differences here. We're talking probably in reality about a month or something, but higher cholesterol levels are associated with greater longevity, and that includes people with familial hypercholesterolemia. Malignant melanoma. Now, you've got several problems with malignant melanoma. One is it is vastly more diagnosed. Yes. Is it vastly more prevalent? Well, we don't know for sure, but I don't think it is. We are just, everyone has become so much more aware of it. You can get malignant melanoma. A friend of mine, their mother died of malignant melanoma. And do you know where it developed? The inside lining of her nose.
I was going to say between the toes or something like that. I've heard of cases like that.
Somewhere where the sun cannot shine.
Yeah.
You can get malignant melanomas of the esophagus and the vagina and all sorts of places. The truth is that, and they've done this study looking at people who have been diagnosed with malignant melanoma, who were then studied. And they found that those people, the ones who had the greatest amount of sun damage, whatever you call sun damage to be, in other words, they had been more sun exposed. Those people who had been diagnosed with malignant melanoma, those who then showed the greatest amount of sun damage, I don't like that word, but we use it for now, were least likely to develop secondary malignant melanomas. Fact. All right.
So you're talking about people with rough skin. What do we call it? Solar keratosis, or
that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're saying is obviously someone who's had a malignant melanoma is probably advised to stay out of the sun and stuff like that. But the ones who stayed out of the sun least who went into the sun most were least likely to develop secondary malignant melanomas. It protected them. People just go with this. Blah, blah, blah. There's another study from one I use quite a lot, which is from Sweden. And they put them into five categories, highest sun exposure to lowest sun exposure. The ones who had the highest sun exposure were likely to live 8 years longer than the ones who had the lowest sun exposure, which is approximately equal to smoking 40 cigarettes a day.
So your hypothesis for general health is to get outside, enjoy fresh air, and get as much sunshine as you possibly can within reason. Lead a long and healthy life.
It will be one of the most important things that you can do, yes. And
what about vitamin D supplementation then?
Well, it's not just vitamin D. Vitamin D is one thing which is very important. But actually, the substance of criticality is called nitric oxide. Don't worry, you've never heard of it. But it is possibly the single most important little molecule in your body, nitric oxide. No one even knew it existed till 20 years ago. No one believed it could exist in the human body, as it's incredibly reactive. Nitric oxide protects against cancer. It protects, it supplements your immune system, and it also protects against heart disease, because nitric oxide protects the lining of your arteries. It's the most powerful protector of your lining of your arteries you can find. It's the single most important substance for cardiovascular disease health. And in fact, ironically, of course, Viagra or sildenafil, people who take Viagra or sildenafil, and its primary action is to increase nitric oxide. That's why it gives you an erection, because an erection is caused by nitric oxide synthesis in the penis. And it also...
Thank you for that. Well, we've been told for some time, though, haven't we, that the little blue pill is very good for your health, even if you're not sexually active.
Yes. Well, it is good for your health. I mean, there are other ways to increase your nitric oxide, but sun exposure is a very good way of doing it.
And is there any supplementation that you can use then? Is there any, vitamins you can take?
You can take a thing called L-arginine, which is you can buy at various supplement places. And L-arginine is part of the enzyme system that drives nitric oxide synthesis production. So that is quite helpful. The guy that discovered nitric oxide, Ignari or whatever his name is, he runs clinics in the States where he just basically gives people L-arginine and L-carnitine, and that increases your nitric oxide and it protects against heart disease. I mean, it works. It definitely does, but you can get L-arginine through consumption of meat, actually. Well, yeah. Also contains quite a lot of it. So if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, I would advise using L-arginine, because you're not getting enough nitric oxide through the natural systems. Beetroot has got quite a lot of L-arginine in it. So that's quite effective.
Thanks for that. I hate beetroot, but tell me, Malcolm,
I don't eat beetroot either. But
you work as a GP. You mentioned earlier on that your court case or the article about you involved Asim Malhotra, who was in New Zealand just on a year ago, making a series of presentations about the COVID vaccine, magnificently received, and what a great man he is, what a great presenter he was. He's a cardiologist. Does he think along the same lines as you on matters of cardiovascular disease?
Yes.
He does, yeah. And he is battling the same establishment as you in terms of cause and effect and cures and
treatment. He has been more outspoken than I. He's more under attack than I am. He chose to highlight the issues with the COVID vaccine, which, because of my court case, I chose not to. I think he's gone a little, I say too far, I'm not quite sure if that's the right word. The COVID vaccine had a number of issues as far as I was concerned, even before it launched, because I knew what it was designed to do. And what the COVID vaccine is designed to do is to cause the body to create spike proteins, and spike proteins lock on to A2 receptors in endothelial cells. They then enter those endothelial cells, at which point those cells will send out a message saying, I have been infected and I need to be killed. All right, that's what cells do. If you infect a cell with a virus, it basically sends out a thing called cytokines, which is protein messengers around the body going to the immune system, I've been infected, come and kill me, because I'm now the danger to the organism, if you like. And the immune system comes along and says, right, well, I'll be killing you, and I'll be killing you. And you may have heard of the cytokine storm that was with the COVID, was the thing that killed a lot of people, was people suddenly produced a huge amount of cytokines. The immune system went into overdrive, basically obliterated the endothelial cells and all cells around the body, and caused a gigantic shutdown and blood clotting and death, all right? And, COVID was doing that to a much greater degree, but if you're going to introduce the spike protein into the body and it's going to be preferentially attracted to cells that have got this particular receptor, which is your endothelial cells and your heart cells, your myocardium, your pericardium, then I sat there and thought, you have to be bloody careful with this stuff, because if the body does start producing, you know, spike proteins in cells, then the immune system gets interested. You know, we could be causing blood clotting and damage to organs around the entire body if we're not careful, right? And I don't think we were particularly careful. So, in fact, the whole COVID thing was all linked back around to my ideas about heart disease. And I wrote a few things, but I didn't get particularly irate about it. But I did think this is quite significantly, potentially quite a dangerous thing to be doing. And maybe it doesn't cause a huge problem for most people. And obviously it doesn't, otherwise we'd all be dead. And we're not. So, but you have to be careful. Because once you fire up the immune system, especially in a fire out the immune system that starts saying rather large areas of the body are now alien, which is what they're designed to do, you just got to be careful with that. And there's a lot of people I've been reading who were very concerned and still remain very concerned that if we keep using boosters, we will potentially cause chronic problems that really are going to be difficult to sort out. So no, Asim was much more vocal about it. I spoke to him about it. We share our ideas on it. And like many things, you can be wrong. I might be utterly wrong that it's going to cause.
Well, as a GP, Malcolm, are you injecting your patients? Are you recommending it to your patients? Are you giving them informed consent about it? What are you doing?
I remain cowardly.
What's that mean?
It means I don't make a huge amount of noise about it, because I've been referred to the General Medical Council about it a couple of times, even for the very mild things that I've said. And although I'm on the cusp of retiring, which means I should say it, but also because of the court case, my lawyer said, do not become involved in COVID because...
I can understand that. But did you vaccinate your patients when they asked for it?
Well, I had nothing to do with vaccination, luckily. I did get a couple. I got.
But your nurses do that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, other people. It's a process out with my world. I don't do any of that stuff. GPs now don't do any of that stuff either. It's all done by external bodies. So
really,
it's,
why is that? Because in New Zealand, GPs still vaccinate.
Yeah. Well, they did it first, but in the UK, it all became pharmacists and hospitals and vaccination groups and whatever. So it's nothing to do with us. Really anymore. It's been taken out of our hands, essentially. So well, I had a couple of vaccines, also from the rather pathetic idea that I wanted to travel abroad and you couldn't travel abroad without being vaccinated. So I kind of made the decision, is it likely to be this bad for me or not? And I decided, well, I'll risk it. And I didn't feel I was risking it.
You have been COVID vaccinated, but
yes.
You wanted to take a trip, and that's understandable. But you felt as if, I think the word that we put about in this country is you were coerced into it, weren't you?
Well, basically, yes. I wouldn't have taken, you know, put it another way, having looked at it all, having looked at the potential benefits, having looked at the amount of safety testing that these vaccines went through, blah, 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 I would not have taken them to protect my health. I just wouldn't have done it.
No, but did you?
I might be wrong on that.
Did you take them also to protect your job? I mean, could you have kept on working as a GP if you hadn't been vaccinated?
It would have been very difficult. Yes, it would have been very difficult. There were people losing their jobs for not getting them. It wasn't quite as bad here as it was in New Zealand and Australia. Australia sounded absolutely horrendous.
Well, some states of Australia, especially Victoria, the restrictions down there were just ludicrous. But, you know, in New Zealand, where we don't have vaccine mandates anymore, we still have, and these are sure anecdotal stories, nurses and doctors who have either left the profession or will not be rehired because they don't have the necessary vaccination schedule up to date, which I find ludicrous when you've got staff shortages.
Well, it is ludicrous in many, many ways. In the UK, we are not there. It almost seems to have disappeared as a thing completely here, as far as I'm aware. I've never heard of anything recently. So I think that, I think a wise man once said it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled. Now, I don't think anyone was fooling, you know, it was a panic stations. It was a weird and difficult time. I mean, I wrote a blog very early on in the COVID thing saying, basically, it's all bollocks and lockdown is bollocks. And it's even if it achieved what it said it was going to do, it was going to be so hugely expensive and the damaging adverse effects of it would be so vast that it just could not be justified. Everything that I wrote in that blog has turned out to come true.
Absolutely, 100% correct. And it was so obvious at the time. But what's the old saying that there is nothing to fear but fear itself? And the politicians were just delighted to be able to put the fear of Jesus into their population. And that really is the biggest crime that the politicians created, really, not just in the UK, not just in New Zealand, but all over the Western world.
It was, you know, I always knew the veneer of civilization was remarkably thin. And the urge to totalitarianism is always there, but I didn't think it would be quite as thin and scary as it became. I was very, I mean, when it first came here, there was like, you can't go out for a walk, you know, you can't go out into the countryside for a walk. So, I mean, they cordoned off parking places in the middle of nowhere. You know, I went out for a walk with my son very early on and we were walking over, it doesn't really matter where we were walking. There was no one else around. But I still thought, you know, there's about four houses in 50 square miles or something. And I just thought, one of these bastards is going to phone the police, aren't they? I said, there are people walking in the hills.
Oh,
they
should
be arrested and re-educated in a re-education camp.
The stupidest thing to me was golf courses. It said every golf course in New Zealand was closed. Get a more wide open space than a golf course? Even if they said you must play by yourself, that would be, I would have thought, completely a logical thing to do. But no, you can't possibly do that because, heaven forbid, you might have some airborne particle which might travel 500 metres and affect somebody else on the other side of the golf course. I mean, it was just ludicrous.
There are those who, you know, if you were to say the things we are saying to each other now, would just consider us to be irresponsible idiots who understand nothing of anything. There's still many of those out there. But equally, there's many more people who just think, what the bloody hell?
Yeah, I know. So, Malcolm, getting back to the original subject of this conversation, your trial, your pushback against the Mail on Sunday, and more particularly your attitude towards statins, will the prescriptions for them drop now? Will the number of patients with heart disease who don't want to use statins, don't want to take statins, do you think that will decrease as a consequence of this case and the fact that what you have been writing now is most likely true? Will there be a different attitude amongst the British population to the use of statins?
I hope so. I'm not deluding myself of the enormity of the task, there are more and more people. There's more doctors than you would realize that think it's all bunk as well. But, you know, you have a job to do and you have a life to live and earnings to be made. And most people won't really rock the boat. But I think that I intend to try and make it much more clear. I'm going to go partly through the political route to ensure, I think, one of the things that needs to happen. And if I said there's one thing I'd like, someone said, what would you like to happen now? I said, well, the thing that I find quite astonishing is that if a pharmaceutical industry pays what they call an expert, whatever that is, money directly. So Merck pays Professor Collins £50,000 or £100,000 or £1 million or whatever it is. And that's what they call a conflict of interest, which is a bad thing because it means that people might think you are being influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. Well, of course you are. But what happens now is that rarely happens. Is what happens, the pharmaceutical industry will pay the University of Cambridge or the University of Auckland or the University of whatever, who will have set up a research organization or some sort of a thing within their university. That whatever that body is called, will then receive large sums of money from the pharmaceutical industry. And they will then do various things, and they'll do research, and they'll give talks, and they'll be part of guideline committees and blah, blah, blah. Basically influencing everything that happens around the world. And they will say, because they're paid by the university, that they do not have a conflict of interest. Now, I find this utterly ridiculous. It's what I call reputation laundering, right? Money laundering. Yeah, A pays C, that's a conflict of interest. A pays B, who then pays C, that is not a conflict of interest. So now you have all these experts around the world going, I have no conflicts of interest. I have never been paid by the pharmaceutical industry for anything. And you go, no, you haven't. But, you know, if you were a journalist writing for, say, a Rupert Murdoch newspaper, and said, well, Rupert Murdoch has never paid me any money. I get paid by The Sun or whatever newspaper Rupert Murdoch owns in New Zealand. You know, does anyone have any doubt that that journalist is going to be freed from bias or will not be basically parroting the ideas of the owner of the newspaper? So the pharmaceutical companies basically own the experts nowadays.
They own the medical schools, don't they? I know that they're huge contributors to medical school funding in this country, and I suspect the same happens in the UK. It most certainly does in the US.
Oh, well, in the US, it's just a complete basket case. But, you know, we have a world which is, you know, as I sometimes say to people, you know, we should be marching in Parliament with burning torches and pitchforks demanding change, because this is really corrupt stuff. That I believe it to be corruption, really. That there's no other word for it.
Well, you said you were going to go down the political route. So what, are you thinking of standing for Parliament or getting involved in the political game?
A bit like with Asim is starting with MPs and then ministers and then trying to gain their ear, if you like, and then asking them to take it up. So hopefully there are some politicians in our country who would, if they knew this, would be quite keen to make it one of their things, if you like.
And so what's the new regime in the UK thinking in terms of, I don't even know off the top of my head who your new Secretary of State for Health is or your new Health Minister is?
Our State for Health is called Wes Streeting, who, if I'm going to influence him, I'd better not say what I might suggest I think about him, but he's quite socialist, quite left-wing, which puts it in a better possibility that he might be willing to think this was quite a good thing for...
Well, he wants to knock down those dirty capitalists, so let's find a way to...
Yes, he wants to knock down the dirty capitalists.
To stop their influence.
Although there will no doubt be a million people whispering in his ear, as they say, Wormer, Grime Tongue, or whatever the name is from the Lord of the Rings. Essentially saying, oh, no, but these people are so helpful and they're so useful and we need them so much and we should not do anything to upset them and they won't invest in our country anymore and blah, blah, blah. There'll be all that bullshit going on, which is very powerful. I mean, it was, Eisenhower who warned about the industrial military complex. You know, I think we have a pharmaceutical, pharmaceutical industry.
Pharma industrial complex, yeah. And I think that probably applies throughout the Western world, doesn't it? All through Europe, the United States, Australia, New Zealand.
It's huge, and they're really good at it. And they're very, scary. Some people have said, are you not worried you'll be assassinated? And I said, no, I'm not. I am not. They don't assassinate you physically. They assassinate your reputation. They assassinate everything you write. They damn you. They call you a conspiracy theorist. They call you a denier. They call you.
Have you seen the Wikipedia entry about you?
Well, I used to have a Wikipedia. No, you mean the Rational Wiki?
Wiki. That's the one I was looking at last night. My goodness, Malcolm Kendrick. Yeah. I shouldn't even be talking to you, frankly, because you are just the biggest kook of all time.
I am the biggest kook of all time. Yes, it's true. No, I mean, I don't know who the hell these people – I mean, Rational Wiki, you think – I tried to look them up, and I had a look and search around, and they've got a weird – you know, they call themselves things like Soup Dragon and you know, it's like, you know, come out and fight. If you want to have a debate, come out and fight. Don't just hide behind some stupid thing.
Okay, well, that's the thing about it. You have, at times during the course of this conversation, got quite technical, quite scientific. Do you, as a long-standing medical professional, as a GP, obviously deeply interested in research, have you had conversations, contests of ideas with people who take the exact opposite view to you? And surely isn't that, after all, the basis of science, the idea that thoughts, thinking, research, data, evidence can be put up from both sides and you can come to some kind of decision, some kind of outcome?
Well, absolutely. That is science. Science is basically skepticism, or as Richard Feynman said, science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. But I think that, yes, I mean, I might be wrong. Of course, I find that highly unlikely, but I might be wrong.
Yes, because modesty is another one of your great attributes.
My great attribute. Modesty is my number one virtue. You need, you know, if you attack something and they successfully defend it, great. Well, it strengthens it, doesn't it? If you, you know, if someone came to me and said, right, this stuff you've talked about, sunshine not causing melanoma, this is rubbish, I'll go, fine. Now, find the evidence. Find the evidence to disprove me. And I'll listen to it, and I'll look at it, and I'll discuss it, and that's great. That's what you should do. But this piling on of, you know, this ridiculous.
Well, it's called the ad hominem attack, isn't it? Attack the player, not the ball.
Absolutely, but it seems remarkably effective, doesn't it? You know, and you get all these, you get 100 professors writing saying cholesterol causes heart disease. It's a fact, or LDL causes cholesterol. It's a fact. Signed. Professor this, that, the next thing, list of names as long as you like.
It's the old science by consensus, isn't it? There are many, many topics around the world that you could lay that label on.
Well, science is, unfortunately, is the ultimate tyranny. It's the tyranny of the truth. And however many people you gain to your side, it doesn't mean you're right. When Albert Einstein was attacked by 100 eminent physicists about his ideas on the space-time continuum and relativity, his response was, well, if they were right, it only needed to be one.
Yeah. Well, didn't Nicholas Copernicus die in prison because...
Well, I think he might have.
Because he said the earth was round and not flat, and the priest put him in prison and he died there, and then, heaven forbid, he was right after he died.
He was. He rejected the geocentric view of the universe.
Yeah.
He was right, yes, and he was silenced. I don't think I'm not sure if he ended up in jail, but he definitely was told, if you talk about this ever again, then we'll chop your head off. To which he said, yeah. Well, I think silence is perhaps what I should be doing at this point. I
mean, okay, Malcolm, just finally then, you've had this very big win against the Mail on Sunday. Are they going to print a retraction and say, gee, Dr. Malcolm Kendrick from Macclesfield in Cheshire was correct all along, or is it just going to be like a small little paragraph buried deep on page 43 to say, oops, sorry, we made a mistake. Dr. Kendrick was right.
I don't think you'll get Dr. Kendrick was right at any point, but and I don't think you'll get much of a I discovered fairly recently that you cannot, by law, demand that anyone makes an apology, which I thought I found quite a lot of things about the law, most of them strange, but what you can do is you can put a statement to be read out in court, which can be, has to be agreed by the judge, so it means this is what the judge agreed was found, if you like. That your statement is then quite a powerful thing, and we're putting together the statement with as much "we were right all along" stuff in it, and that will be read out in court. That will be the final say on the judgment.
So this is from Justice Nicklin, but the question is then, will that statement be reported in mainstream media to have some vindication for yourself and your colleagues?
I'll do everything in my power to ensure that it is. mainstream media is about as interested in scientific fact as you'd expect it to be.
Yeah, but there might be some other media organisations, some other newspaper organisations who might want to give Associated Newspapers a bit of a kick up the bum as well. So Murdoch mob or the Telegraph Company?
Yeah. I've got quite a number of contacts around the world with various people. I will be spreading the news far and wide, how much of it gets reported. But I think the main thing that I have now is a greater degree of being able to say some of the things that I previously had to be a little more circumspect about.
Sure. And you've still got your medical registration. You can still work as a doctor.
I'm about to give that up just because I'm retiring, because I'm an old git anyway. So,
were you ever under threat, by the way? Did the regulators, those who issue the licenses, ever come after you at any stage or threaten you at any stage?
A couple of times, yes. Once over the heart disease stuff, and once over COVID vaccination stuff. Neither of them really went anywhere, because the registration people in the UK are rather terrified of things becoming public that they would rather not become public. Should we put it that way?
Yeah, sure. But there have been numerous doctors in this country who have basically ended their careers. They've been martyrs to the cause. And you may or may not know of some of them. They formed an organisation here called New Zealand Doctors Speaking Up with Science, NZDSOS. And they have achieved a certain amount of, I guess the word is infamy, around the country, but they still keep on battling hard. And they're being proved more and more right, more and more correct, almost with every passing day.
Yes. I think that these things that take an awful long time is, I mean, whether it's a good analogy or not, I think that if people wish to trust the system, especially the medical system, because what they don't want is thinking, well, these people don't know what they're talking about. This pill might be damaging for me and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, the average person still has a great degree of trust in the doctor. Doctors still have a great deal of trust in the system, because to think or be otherwise is a very uncomfortable place to be. And the politicians like the system as it stands. And so it's a kind of self-reinforcing thing to try and crack that and say, really, there's some fundamental and gigantic problems here that are essentially, you know, that we have to do something about it. Is a tough ask, a very tough ask. And I understand that, but I think eventually, as it was a bit like saying the idea that, say, you know, priests were actually paedophiles, was a really tough ask for the Catholic Church itself, the people who were Christian Catholics, the people going to church, the people knowing their local priest, et cetera, et cetera. You know, for them to actually turn around and go, blimey, this is actually awful. You know, that took a hell of a long time. And for people to turn around and say the medical research world, or whatever term you use for it, has become so corrupted that it's almost difficult to believe anything that comes out anymore. That's a tough ask. You
know, yeah, but we still have the celebrated case, don't we, Malcolm, of thalidomide. I know it's, 50 years ago, but that was proved to be incredibly damaging, and eventually that case was won. Maybe there will be more repeats of the thalidomide outcome in the next decade or two decades. For those of our age, it might be a long, long wait. We may never see it, but surely in the end, justice has got to prevail.
I think it will. In the end, it will prevail. You know, I hate to keep using analogies, but you know, people in the Middle Ages used to be building cathedrals. They knew they'd never see it completed, but they were very glad that they were putting some of the pieces in place that would end up with this magnificent building. And I think I sort of see myself in that kind of role of, I'm trying to put bricks in it together. I'm trying to create this structure that will be something valid and useful and great. But it's a long journey that you just hand over to the next person and say, we just keep battling. And at some point, yes, you're right. At some point, this will all collapse around some people's ears, not our ears. Whether we see it in our lifetime, I don't know. I hope that I do. But if I don't, at least I can say I did try and I did my best. And at least well, my best wasn't good enough, but at least I did do it. And I think I encourage myself with that thought, really, I think.
Very good. Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. And I wish you the best. And thank you so much for your time here on Reality Check Radio.
There we go. Thank you very much.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.